Hi, my name is Jim Lewis.
And my name is Chris Painter.
Welcome to season two of Inside Cyber Diplomacy, a casual and we hope revealing conversation with Jim and I and our guest of the week that hopes to go behind the scenes and really tell the story of what's going on.
Today's guest is Ron Diebert, an old friend for both Chris and I, founder of the Citizen Lab at the Monk School for Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. He was a principal investigator for some of the work we've seen on NSO and other surveillance technologies. Ron, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
We have a lot of ground to cover, and I know Chris has a lot of questions, but maybe you could start by telling us, this is a podcast about cyber diplomacy. Tell us where civil society fits in on that. When you hear the word civil society, cyber diplomacy, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. What I think of is how the community has grown in the time frame that I've been involved in this area, from a point 20 years ago when it was pretty meager, there weren't too many people. I mean, some civil society organizations were coming from siloed areas around data privacy or aspects of human rights, and there wasn't much there. There wasn't much meat. But now I think the community has grown far more effective, I would say, at least in terms of coordinating who's going where and sharing information through various channels. I'm not sure it's actually having much of an impact, but certainly the community has grown and become more diverse and is usually pretty fairly well represented at some of these forums. Although both of you are more active participants than I am, especially in the international fora. So I see it as something that's positive, the growth of the civil society community in this space.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think you may be the first or the second quote unquote civil society. I always love the term civil society because I never know exactly what it means. It's such a broad term. It's like, you know, when you say industry, it's a very varied, it's even more varied than industry, frankly. It's all kinds of groups, as you said. But I think it's important. The interesting thing is every Western government talks about the importance of multi-stakeholder involvement and civil society. So they all talk the talk.
Yeah.
But walking the walk is not is necessarily follows completely. I think some are better than others in that.
And that's true.
And certainly the processes, all these UN processes are not exactly the gold standard for involving civil society.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The dynamic I've observed is that usually when it comes to cybersecurity, it's one of those realpolitik issues. And usually if there is any discussion from or about civil society or human rights for that matter, it's usually tacked on at the end of a program, usually like an afterthought or bit of window dressing. Let's tackle that other set of topics which are more important first and then get to the concerns around civil society, which I've always found problematic for obvious reasons. I think that human rights and the rule of law are core to what it is that we should be securing. So for many years, I found that a bit frustrating to see discussions around cybersecurity with that as a kind of add-on. However, I've observed, especially from our own research, that civil society is often ahead of the curve on a lot of these topics. So for example, the Citizen Lab was part of the research team that published the very first public evidence-based report on cyber espionage back in 2009, which was the GhostNet report. The way that we discovered that network of espionage was starting with Tibetan communities who were canaries in the coal mine. And then because the operators of that espionage operation made mistakes, we were able to gain visibility into a much broader set of victims worldwide, which included governments and industry. But it was because of our connections to civil society victims that we were able to surface this massive espionage campaign. And it's been true ever since. We've been one step ahead because a lot of governments around the world don't see other governments as the principal risk to their national security. They're mostly concerned about regime stability, which means that they are focused on civil society, both domestically and increasingly, thanks to the internet and social media, abroad as well. So we're seeing transnational repression. And I thought it was interesting in the latest ODNI threat assessment, There's a major section on both transnational repression and spyware proliferation, things that, as you both know, I've been warning about for well over a decade now. These are now seen as principal national security risks. So it was because of the perspective of civil society, if you will, that these issues are now on the table. So sometimes civil society is ahead of the curve.
Tell us how spyware fits into this, because you've done a ton of work on spyware. It's on and off a hot topic, but it is clearly something that is an intrusive, extraterritorial tool. It's also used nationally, but where do you see spyware fitting into the diplomacy of cyberspace?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think going back again to those very first investigations that we and others did on cyber espionage, looking mostly at China and Russia at the time, we were interested in tactics and procedures and methods, how these government actors were engaging in cyber espionage. And I can recall around 2010, 2011, around the time of the Arab Spring, recognizing and appreciating that, hey, there's a market for these intrusion capabilities. There are private companies that are servicing governments, so they can go out and purchase capabilities that they can't develop in-house. And at least for me, I first heard about this around the time of the Arab Spring. You may remember protesters broke into the Egyptian security services headquarters and, you know, rifled through filing cabinets and found contracts between the Egyptian intelligence agencies and European surveillance companies. And that was really the first glimpse. Very shortly afterwards, though, again, thanks to our relationship with victims, we started investigating cases of the abuse of spyware. So in other words, governments using hacking tools to go after political opposition, dissidents, journalists, and so on. The technology is marketed by these firms to assist governments in legitimate use cases. So to help them investigate crimes or important issues around national security, like investigating terrorism. But the problem is, because of the lack of regulation, government clients use them for whatever purpose they want. And like I said before, for many governments, the principal security concern is not necessarily what an adversary state is doing. It is what civil society is doing, or what journalists may uncover, or what some political opposition may do that presents a risk to the regime. And so they're using these very powerful tools to hack into the devices of those actors and neutralize them. Obviously, this is not the way it's marketed. I don't know what proportion of use cases there are, because we don't, through our research, we've surfaced a ton of abuse cases, but we're obviously not seeing the whole picture. But I can say for sure there's a substantial number of governments that routinely abuse this type of technology. And meanwhile, the technology is getting more and more powerful. So back in 2011, we were able to capitalize on the fact that there had to be some kind of interaction with victims. So usually this meant, you know, an SMS or a text message sent to a target. They would need to click on a link to generate the exploit, which would then implant the spyware on a device. That would enable us to track the infrastructure and verify that certain people are being targeted. Well, fast forward to today, and the latest versions of spyware are known as zero click, meaning they require no victim interaction. 1 minute your phone is fine, the next it's streaming data to a bunker in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. That's very powerful, almost godlike capabilities, considering how much personal information is contained in a phone. The market for this type of service is proliferating quite widely. I mean, we know of a few very prominent firms in this space, most of which are based in or originate from Israel. But as the ODNI report said yesterday, 74 countries around the world are known to be clients of this type of technology. And Google had a list of, I think, several dozen firms that they published about recently as well. So it's a big market. Technologies are proliferating. They're becoming more sophisticated. And unfortunately, there's very little restriction on how it's used by those end user clients. And we're seeing a lot of abuses as a result. And I would situate spyware, by the way, in a broader palette of surveillance and intrusion capabilities of which it is a part. I think it's the most powerful, because if you can get inside somebody's phone, it's highly revealing. You can turn on the microphone, turn on the camera, track somebody's location. But you can accomplish similar things if you use, for example, advertising intelligence beacons, which are routinely traded, again, with very little regulation. And many government agencies are using what's known as ADINT, advertising intelligence, and firms are marketing those capabilities to government clients to enable them to track people, again, for purposes like transnational repression or even targeted assassinations.
You've been raising this issue for a long time. I'm been on your distribution list when I was in the government. I've seen all the reports that you've done, and they're great reports. They're very in-depth. You've called attention to things I think people weren't paying attention to. But it must have been a little frustrating, too, because you kept doing this. And there really wasn't that kind of policy wake-up moment until relatively recently. I mean, relatively recently, you have all this government activity in the U.S. with commercial spyware, executive order, and the summit of democracy. You have this new process that was just launched. I mean, what made this a big issue suddenly for governments, where before it was kind of like one of many issues?
Yeah, that's a good question, Chris. I think that I've thought about it a lot. You're right. There was a lot of attention to the issue. Like, our reports have been routinely covered in world news, so we weren't hurting for publicity around our findings. You know, they're very controversial findings, right? You're surfacing, well, we're basically outing espionage, right? And that's always of interest to news organizations when they can say, oh, Canadian research group has uncovered an espionage operation around Jamal Khashoggi's assassination or whatever. So we got a lot of publicity around it. Civil society was certainly activated around it. In fact, there are now many more groups doing the type of research that the Citizen Lab did, mostly alone for many years, which is very encouraging. But you're right, governments were slow to react. The United States has really led the area by a wide margin, I would say. The Biden administration has taken several steps, which we can talk about. But I think the precipitating factor there was around 2019 with the so-called WhatsApp-related hacks. So to refresh your memory, back in 2019, there was a version of NSO spyware called Pegasus, which was being implanted on targets' devices by exploiting a flaw in WhatsApp video call messaging. And this was also a zero-click version of the exploit. So we had come across some victims who were experiencing weird drop calls on WhatsApp, and we reported it to WhatsApp. They fixed the flaw, and then working with the Citizen Lab, we notified all of the civil society victims that we could see. But among those victims were U.S. government personnel who were using personal phones that had been targeted. I think that was a big wake-up call. Shortly afterwards, you had further indications that this was going on. And you started having hearings, like, for example, under Adam Schiff and the House Intelligence Committee, beginning to realize this is not just a human rights issue. We are very much at risk of this type of proliferation. We need to do something about it. So I think the targeting of U.S. personnel was a wake-up call. Of course, administrations have different priorities. For whatever reason, within the Biden White House, there were people who, A, thought this was important, that the United States should take some action, and it really began to move on the issue, as did the Commerce Department. So in 2021, the Commerce Department started putting several spyware firms and hack-for-hire firms on the designated entity list. So that it was really around that 2020, 2021, when we started to see movement in the United States.
I think it was a big mistake for customers to target Americans, because that was probably the American officials. That was probably the decisive factor in talking to some of the people involved.
Very dumb mistake.
It was one thing that this will sound dreadful, but it's one thing to spy on others. It's another thing to spy on American officials. But how much of this, Ron, would you call the privatization of espionage? I mean, these tools you're talking about have been in the community for more than a decade, but now they're private. Is this the privatization of surveillance of espionage or what?
Yeah, it definitely is. That's how I describe it. And you think about what spyware represents is really only one component of what we call espionage. As you both know, governments have a range of tools at their disposal. Well, every single one of these tools in the toolkit are now commercially available, not just the use of spyware or hacking, but as I described before, location tracking. You also have, of course, private intelligence services that do covert action that perhaps even engage in sabotage, but certainly tracking people in order to dig up information on them and discredit them. You have disinformation for hire. So influence operations now, huge growing market for commercial influence operations, let's call them. Again, part of the clandestine, I would say the privatization of clandestine operations, which I don't think we've really seen in modern history before. And there are many different explanations as to why this is the case, why we're seeing this now, but it's across the board. Privatization of clandestine operations.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit when we were saying about when U.S. government people were targeted, they began to view it as a security matter. And it's interesting that when these two communities come together, then there seems to be action. So, for instance, the security community was raising alarm bells about China theft issues for years and years. And it wasn't until the economic community said, well, this is an economic issue, that then they said, okay, we need to move on this. Yes. So, breaking out of our respective bubbles, to the extent they're bubbles, the human rights community, the security community, you know, that's been an uneven thing, I think. But I think one example is this new process, this Palmall process that was recently launched, and it was talked about a lot last week at the UN OAWG meetings by some, by the UK and France and others who launched it. What are your expectations of that, these kind of processes? Do you think that these are going to make substantive progress? Is it going to just be a small group of countries who are more like-minded? Or what, if you were giving advice to them, and you may be already giving advice to them probably, what would you want to do with processes like that now that you have the attention finally on this issue?
Yeah, well, I should be asking you both this question because you're far more experienced in those venues than I am. On the one hand, I think it's quite encouraging. Any time this matters on the radar, when governments are meeting and talking about international norms, it's a net positive for those of us who have been working hard on the research side. We're not an advocacy group, so I don't really go around promoting certain policies. I certainly observe what's going on. Mostly, our job at the Citizen Lab, at least, has been to surface evidence. And then hope in doing so that this wakes governments up to do something. Of course, we have recommendations. As I said earlier, the United States government is way in front of this compared to any other government in the world. The executive order was profoundly impactful. And then you had just time with the Palmall process, visa restrictions, and then more recently, individual sanctions against people who profit from this industry. You know, that's like three big sledgehammers right there on the industry that sends a loud signal. No other government has done anything like that. But we do have the Palmall process, which is, you know, a statement of principles. By the way, there was a statement of principles of 11 countries that was pushed out at the same time as Biden's executive order on spyware. So I don't see the Palmall process as being much different than that statement of principles, other than you have a few more governments buying into this idea that, hey, this is a problem. So great, we have words. What would actions look like? I think it would look a lot like what the United States government is doing, mirrored in other governments like Canada, like the UK, like France. The big elephant in the room here, though, as you both know, is that every government has a dog in this race, to use that language, and they're heavily conflicted. So they all employ the capabilities that we're talking about to greater or lesser degrees. And there are some hard limits to the extent that they're willing to go to regulate, which has always been something done in the shadows. And there are stakeholders in all of these governments that really don't like the idea of more transparency, more accountability, more oversight, which is ultimately where this leads. If you continue with, okay, let's start having a designated entity lists where we identify bad firms. Let's start issuing visa restrictions against bad actors. Inevitably, this leads towards, well, we should be more accountable about our own procurement. Who do we buy from? What are the firms that we're procuring from? If there are bad firms out there, who are the good ones? that is opening up this black box and peering into agencies that aren't comfortable with sunlight. And that's the same for any liberal democratic government out there. They just don't like that type of scrutiny. So part of the solution for me is more independent oversight, more transparency, more public accountability around security agencies, especially because we've been talking about spyware. But as I said before, I think these agencies live in a golden age of surveillance right now, in part because of the personal data surveillance economy. Surveillance capitalism, if you will, is doing the job for them. And they can go out and procure a lot of data that's basically the exhaust of surveillance capitalism. And there are firms that are standing up, you know, all sorts of products and services that allow intelligence agencies and law enforcement to do things that were unthinkable 10 years ago, which to me really underscores the urgency for those of us who care about liberal democracy of making sure we have proper checks and balances for the age we live in. The way I see it is we're going through a period of a great leap forward in state capabilities of information control and surveillance, but our checks and balances are from the Victorian era, or at least the mid-20th century, and they need to catch up. And that's is in the distance between those two where the prospect of the abuse of power lies. And we have to be sensitive to that if we care about liberal democracy and human rights and the rule of law. As we all know, state security agencies will overstep their boundaries and their long stories of abuse of power involving the FBI, CIA, whatever. We need proper checks and balances in place to preserve our freedoms and our rights.
This really drags us into a different area, though, because I was going to ask you about that. The big players in intelligence don't need the commercial firms. So one thing, a lot of the capabilities you describe have really been available to state actors for years. Right now, they're commercially available. One thing would be to say, focus on the commercial actors, you know, that you can't, that avoids this problem you have here, but you are touching on something that's come up and will come up again. You have the OECD guidelines on government use of data. You have the debate in the US on spies of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. I mean, one of the things you said that leapt out at me, of course, everything you said leapt out at me, but one thing that leapt out was 25 countries signed the Pall Mall process. It's not binding. And for me, it doesn't count if it's not binding. It's nice to have, but you then said the DNI identified 74 countries using this stuff. What explains the disparity? Is it fixable? I mean, you've got three parts here. Those who can do whatever they want, those who have to buy it, and those who apparently use it but might not commit to any principles. Where do we fall on that?
Well, I think there's some troubling trends emerging because of the dynamics around what the U.S. has set in motion with more regulation around this space as the landscape is shifting a bit. And in fact, the Israeli government has, prior to October 7th, was starting to crack down on its domestic industry. It was, as I heard anyway, they were being more strict in terms of granting licenses to some of the firms that were exporting spyware. But as a consequence, principals involved in those firms were migrating to other jurisdictions. And as we speak, I know there is a big appetite in the Gulf countries, in the UAE in particular, to stand up surveillance vendors that are based in those jurisdictions. If you don't have those governments signing on in a meaningful way to something like the pledges we're talking about, then you're going to have a big hole in the regulatory landscape. And there'll be companies thriving because there'll always be governments with an appetite for this sort of thing who won't participate in any type of control. In fact, the opposite, they will want to use it. And that really concerns me. You know, you mentioned earlier that some governments are able to do this all in-house. Even there, I wonder if that's entirely true. Certainly they can pay for it. But again, there's a long history of outsourcing to private companies in the United States. I mean, look at the jurisdiction within which you live, Jim. Within a 100-mile radius, there are all these big firms that enjoy defense contracts and are involved in standing up. They work within the tent, if you will, but they're still private companies. And those private companies can foster the marketplace either directly or indirectly. For example, vulnerabilities are part of the way in which the spyware works. You need to have an exploit to be able to crack a phone and put spyware on it. There's a market for that. And it's true that some countries have very talented personnel that can discover these exploits, but really it comes from purchasing them from vendors that focus solely on that. And not many governments are willing to really get to the heart of what we call the vulnerabilities equities process to have more accountability and transparency over when is it okay for a government to know about a flaw in some critical piece of software and keep that to themselves, as opposed to disclosing it to the vendors in the public interest. It's a big puzzle.
I mean, that's interesting because it was also, oddly, the U.S. that led in that, having the first government vulnerabilities equities process. And I think the U.K. followed. But a lot of countries still, a lot of big Western countries still do not have vulnerability equities processes. And it was an interesting change in the U.S. I remember Keith Alexander saying their default went to hold to disclose, which is a big change. Now, it doesn't mean everything gets disclosed and you're not going to have a process that's fully transparent, but I think we've been arguing for years. I know that global commission I was on said every country should have this. More have them than they used to have, but you're never going to get them from some countries who were abusers anyway. But you know, how do you draw that? How do you draw more attention to that? Because that's a parallel strand, it seems to me, as you said, is getting more countries really interested in embracing this idea that they're not giving up necessarily their security. They're actually helping victims by you know, getting these things out there.
Yeah, and that's very true and interesting history around all of that. And I think you're right. In my country, for example, in Canada, there are people signal that it's an important issue, but I haven't seen any progress around it here that's actually tangible. But getting back to the UAE and the development of the mercenary spyware marketplace there, this will be the real challenge around controlling proliferation in this space, is that there will be vendors outside of the regulatory community and countries with an appetite that also won't sign on to something like that. And the reach is truly global for this type of technology, which enables the type of transnational repression that a lot of people are concerned about. So I don't know how to fix that, actually. I think that's going to be a very big challenge. I could see other governments going in the direction that the United States has, which is very positive. But beyond that, I don't know. And what do we do when there are Chinese, Indian, Gulf-based firms that are willing to sell to any government client or even private sector? There are hack-for-hire firms out there that are willing to sell to big corporations that enable them to hack adversary devices as we speak. It's illegal, but it happens. And as long as they're willing providers, it will go on.
You touched on a topic that we have discussed many times on this podcast, and that is, how do you get accountability? And let me use a proliferation model. The initial signers of the missile technology control regime were very few in number. But what they had was, it wasn't a binding agreement, although it was nationally binding. But they had clear guidelines, kind of like the Pall Mall principles, a little clearer perhaps. But they also had a willingness to go out and lobby those who were ignoring, who were proliferating, who were developing missile programs. And do you think we'll ever get to where countries will do that? I mean, I worry about the larger erosion of sort of this debate. Is it a universal norm or is it a Western norm? And if it's a Western norm, then having the people who signed the Pall Mall thing show up may not be as persuasive. But
well, it's interesting. The missile technology control regime made me think of dual-use technologies and the challenges of verifying proliferation controls when technology is dual-use. Here, we have such a blurring of boundaries, especially when, if you broaden out from just spyware to look at the larger surveillance apparatus and toolkit that's available to security agencies today from the commercial marketplace, so much of it originates from the social media ecosystem working as intended, right? So we have an ecosystem that is invasive by design, insecure, I wouldn't say by design, but insecure from the ground up all the way up to the devices we hold in our pocket, as a manifestation of the fact that the principal philosophy is just to move applications out as quickly as possible, layered on top of other applications. So you have this pervasive insecurity, invasive by design, poorly regulated, of course, and that leads to all of the abuses that we see. Governments are enjoying that ecosystem, the benefits of that ecosystem, talking about government security agencies. Yeah. So if you want to regulate that, you're really talking about, well, you can't fix it until you fix the fact that we live in this environment that is, on the face of it, legitimate. People participate in it willingly, and it's being exploited by security agencies and bad actors in various ways. So there's a problem I see.
Thank you for titling my next book, The Internet is a Cesspool, but a bit over the top.
Well, when we tried this before, I mean, you know, you remember, Ron and Jim, you certainly do, the experiment of trying to use Vossenaar to get at these things and how effective that was, or lack of effective. I mean, it seems like the difference with the missile proliferation is you also not just had cajoling other countries, you had a stick too. You know, you would give them benefits or threaten them if they didn't get in line on that. And I don't see that happening yet here. Maybe it grows into that over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think of analogies with other arms control regimes in the past and think about how this fits or doesn't fit. I mean, verification is obviously a big challenge here because you're dealing with things that, you know, can't be seen from space the way that, like, a comprehensive test ban around nuclear weapons might be. If we ever got there, it'd be somewhat easier to verify. Oh, you can see somebody's preparing a large cavity in the side of a mountain. Something's going on there. But you don't have that when it comes to this stuff. It's much more difficult to verify, which in and of itself, I think, is a big problem. And then, you know, when you look at successful arms control agreements like landmines, I think there was a recognition that these are of limited utility. And in this case, it's the opposite. It's extremely rewarding to be able to, and addictive, I would say. You know, if you can imagine what it's like to get a picture of someone's entire pattern of life presented to you in a portal, you know, that's, who's going to pass on that? It's much different than something like landmines, where people were already edging toward the fact this is really of limited military utility, and you had a successful agreement in part because of that.
So is it a technology change then? I mean, is the only, we all hope to hear that we'll come up with better technology to block these things? So that's a kind of a
I think one thing we've been talking mostly about what governments can do, but if you think about what Apple alone has done in this space, I'm not a fan of Apple, I'm not promoting Apple, but, and we publish reports very critical of Apple in other areas, just to be clear about that. But what Apple has done is remarkable. So first of all, they're suing one of these firms, NSO Group, in California courts. The litigation that they're involved in alone is symbolically very important. It could be materially quite important as well. If they win that case and their penalties against the firm, that could impact that firm, but also impact the marketplace, introduce a bit more conservative behavior, especially among investors. It's a very lucrative industry. There are private equity funds. They might say, you know, unless you guys clean up your act, we're not going to invest. We heard about this lawsuit. But Apple went further. They actually introduced a new feature called lockdown mode, which, by the way, if you have an iPhone and you don't have lockdown mode enabled, I'd highly recommend you do it, because we've not seen a single instance of any spyware defeating lockdown mode so far. No evidence for it yet. What it's doing, though, is actually reducing the functionality of your device, which is kind of interesting metaphorically, but there you go. If you really want to be protected, extending the logic of that, throw your phone in the ocean and never connect to the internet. But for most people, that's not practical. So, hey, lockdown mode.
Or buy a ZTE phone and just use it for fun application.
Yeah. And then Apple also started notifying victims, which is huge. I mean, we've had several rounds of these Apple notifications going out. Most big tech platforms are very reluctant to do that sort of thing beyond just issuing very general, very vague warnings. Whereas Apple has been quite out front. And for groups like mine who do the investigatory side, it's as if they shook a fruit tree and all of these victims fell to the ground, which have led to, over the last couple of years, revelations of massive cyber espionage in places like Thailand, 35 victims, El Salvador, 35 journalists. We wouldn't have discovered this had it not been for Apple notifying those people, and then they made their way to us. So there are things that can be done on the technology side by the firms, by the vendors, by the platforms, if they're willing to do it. And Apple has shown how it can be done.
What would you do, Ron, to make civil society more effective in the diplomacy of spyware, in the diplomacy of cybersecurity? What would you recommend? Dress better? I mean, what?
Dress you mean better. The diplomats, Jim, or for the...
The diplomats are all going to be wearing suits.
Well, there are some practical constraints around civil society that you both are fully aware of. I mean, one is just the cost of being at the right place at the right time. We had this Pall Mall meeting. Not everyone can fly to London and stay in hotels. Also, the format in some cases is inherently restrictive. I remember, I think you both were there, the big London cyber event. When was that? 2010 or something? 2012. And I remember distinctly being at that meeting, and there was a point in the proceedings when they said, okay, civil society, bye-bye, we're going behind this closed door. They actually went behind a closed door. And I thought, well, that's symbolic of the problem here, that when it boils down to it, it's really multilateral, not so much multi-stakeholder. However, I think there are ways for civil society to be more effective in spite of these constraints. So I said before, my impression is civil society is starting to communicate better and coordinate better. And I'm participating in several groups where we're letting each other know, hey, there's this event coming up, or we've learned that this government is pushing this. Maybe they would like to know X, Y, Z, even the executive order. So the executive order, for something like that to work, needs to be action by civil society. So it's one thing for the administration to say, hey, we're going to not procure from these vendors, but the government officials need to know which vendors not to procure from, and that's something civil society can do. So they need to exercise the executive order, in other words, and that takes work. So being a bit more mature about the process and more targeted, hitting the right governments and the right people in the right places is something that I think is, if it happens, it's a signal of the maturity of the community around this space.
You said signal twice. Is that because you use signal to do this?
It's a bit of a two-way street too, because you used to have a conference years ago, Ron, I remember going to in Toronto. It was always a great conference, and you decided, and the advantage of that conference is it brought the government people who did cybersecurity and diplomacy together with the people who did human rights. And that was relatively unique at the time. Now, you know, there's been, part of it is getting the diplomats to embrace a wider portfolio that includes the human rights. Some countries, the U.S. and many others have, but other countries it's more narrowly focused. How do you get those communities together? I was really happy to see at RightsCon last year in Costa Rica that I think like 20 of the cyber diplomats came because Access Now wanted them there and had a forum. So that was a good example. What else would you do to do that now that your conference is sadly gone? But
yeah, that was an interesting process. We started that because we had an opportunity, frankly, after the GhostNet report came out. Our profile was very large, and we were unique in being able to straddle those communities because everyone was interested in different reasons for the investigation that we did. And so we had this convening power. And honestly, I helped organize it to learn. I wanted to meet people like you and others and find out, well, you know, I'd just like to have conversations and facilitate this dialogue. It was called Cyber Dialogue. It did take a lot of work. Of course, it takes someone to curate something like that. And our main mission was different. We realized that we had a unique opportunity to act as a watchdog, to do the investigatory side, which I found, frankly, a bit more rewarding, the detective work over the convening part. Meanwhile, yeah, RightsCon does a great job. And there are other venues like that, some that are, I would say, more siloed than others. So you'll find mostly cybersecurity people meeting here, human rights people meeting there. It would be a good thing if someone really took the initiative and convened those meetings and help bridge the gap so that we have on a regular rolling basis these conversations.
That was one reason for the Freedom Online Coalition, is that the people were
Yes,
supposed to go to their own governments and talk to the people who weren't at the table. And that's happened somewhat, but not always perfectly. So,
Is the Freedom Online Coalition still active, would you
oh yeah,
say?
very. The US hosted it last year, I think. I think Canada, I think the Netherlands has it now. And they've tried to revive it and make it more strong. So that's good. But as with many of these things, Ron, there's things they've done in the past that have been very useful, like the intersection of security and freedom. And they had great principles that came out, and they got lost in time. I remember, that people, you do all these great things and they become shelfware, which is unfortunate. So, and rediscovery.
Counts as a swing and a miss. Hey, Ron, we've found that the ideal time for podcasts is the amount of time people spend on the treadmill. So we've reached the witch. I'm not making that up. We've reached the witching hour. Any final thoughts? Anything we missed? What would you want to say?
Well, I'll say to you two, it's really been a pleasure in my professional career to get to know you both and learn different things from both of you over the years. And I'm grateful for the time we spent together, especially at the MIT Cyber Norms event, which is something we've all participated in over the years and is one of those venues, I would say, Chris, that you speak of. So if we could do more of that, that would be great. I'm really worried about advertising intelligence. Last word on that. Adint, if you haven't looked into it, there's a great article in Wired magazine recently about it, about the industry. And several other journalists are hot on this area. A Wall Street Journal reporter named Brian Tao has a new book out on the topic. This is really, really concerning. I think the type of fine-grained information you can get from the type of data that's pulled from applications and just circulates through these real-time bidding exchanges that are poorly regulated, to me, is the next frontier for the abuse of surveillance.
Well, I should say also kind of right back at you that it's really been very useful, both when I was in the government and afterwards, and knowing you and your perspectives on these things and reading your reports. It's really opened my eyes to things that I might not have seen without. So thanks for that.
Thank
Appreciate
you
it.
very much. Appreciate it.